Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Joe Peters, and I represent the appellate Daryl Einspar. My attorney registration number is 42328. This case should be remanded for a new trial because of two errors that prevented Mr. Einspar from getting a fair process. First, the trial court applied the wrong standard in considering Mr. Einspar's motion to pay the jury fee out of time. As a result, Mr. Einspar was denied a jury trial. Second, the trial court applied the wrong standard in considering Mr. Einspar's claim for indemnity. As a result, Mr. Einspar was denied a full and complete hearing on that claim. I'll begin with the jury trial question. This court has said that the right to a jury trial in civil cases has been an essential part of Colorado's justice system almost from its inception. The right of a party to have his case tried by a jury is an important and substantial one. Here, Mr. Einspar did not receive a jury trial as a result of a computer glitch. I'll skip over the facts and proceed to the three reasons why the trial court's holding was legally erroneous. First, the court failed to apply the correct legal standard, which was the excusable neglect standard under Rule 6B. Second, under that standard, the circumstances here qualify for an enlargement of time. Third, finally, nothing in the jury trial rules override the trial court's discretion to enlarge deadlines under Rule 6B. Point one, the appropriate standard was the excusable neglect standard under Rule 6B. Einspar, proceeding pro se at this point, made a motion to allow Mr. Einspar to pay the jury fee now. That's a motion to perform an act out of time after the passage of the deadline, and that's a motion under Rule 6B. The trial court understood it to be just such a motion. In its second order on the question, it described Mr. Einspar's motion specifically as, and I quote, a motion to permit him to file the jury fee out of time. That was the motion that Mr. Einspar made. The rule that governs such motions is 6B. The standard there is excusable neglect.
So, Mr. Peters, is it your position then that the issue was preserved before the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Mr. Einspar is a pro se litigant, and he's not a sophisticated litigant. To argue that he didn't raise it because he didn't use magic words like enlargement or 6B would be to elevate form over substance.
So to the extent that you're arguing excusable neglect, you mentioned a computer glitch. What's the computer glitch you're referring to?
So at one point in time, Mr. Einspar was represented by counsel. He managed to hire an attorney maybe about a year into the trial court proceedings, and he was represented for 7 or 8 months before he ran out of money. That attorney moved for leave to file an amended answer. The amended answer was lodged pending the court's order granting or denying leave to file it, and he filed it through the LexisNexis e-filing system. When the court granted the motion, the amended answer itself was filed. There was a demand for a jury trial, but the fee was never assessed by the court clerk or by the LexisNexis system to the attorney's LexisNexis account.
So in the body of the answer, the amended answer, there was a jury demand, but it wasn't captioned answer and jury demand, and there wasn't a request at the end of the pleading for a jury either. Correct?
It was not placed at the end. It was captioned in bold letters, or I believe small caps. And it was set out with white space, above and below. It was fairly conspicuous. It was in the middle after, I believe, the affirmative defenses and before the cross claims. But it was in there. You can find that amended answer. The lodged version is on pages 217 to 225 in the record.
Mr. Peters, I understand that he's a pro se litigant and probably gave the trial court some notice that he wanted to file something out of time, but people file motions for continuances or to extend their deadlines. How would the trial court have been alerted to the excusable neglect standard in Rule 6?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the entire question.
How could the trial court known he was arguing an excusable neglect and not just seeking an extension of time?
In his motion, he did argue that it was somebody else's fault, that the failure to pay the jury fee was through no fault of his own. That is an excusable neglect sort of argument. But most importantly, he used the words. He used the words, to allow Mr. Einsbar to pay the jury fee now. He asked to perform an act after the expiration of the deadline. Those are the words from Rule 6B. And the court understood it as a motion out of time, to perform an act out of time. The court described the motion in its second order. There it is. Einsbar filed a motion to permit him to file the jury fee out of time. He was asking for an enlargement of time after the fact, and the court understood it as just such a motion.
But the court didn't apply the excusable neglect standard?
The court believed it had no discretion. So in that second order on the matter, the court said, the court is not able to reinstate his right to a jury trial without the written authorization of the other parties in the case. The court believed that it had no discretion and relied on everybody else's written consent. That's not the correct standard. Now, that standard does appear twice in the jury trial rules. It appears in Rule 38, when a party who has demanded a jury and paid the fee requests to withdraw its jury demand, all of the other properly demanded and paid parties have to authorize that withdrawal in writing to agree to it. And then also under Rule 39C, you need the court needs the written consent of all the parties in order to impose an advisory jury in an action that's not otherwise triable to a jury. That neither of those rules applies to this motion, and for the court, when the trial court said that it could not grant the motion without the written express authorization of the parties, it was applying the wrong legal standard.
Well, Mr. Peters, if we do assume that the issue was preserved, so is 6B limited only to deadlines that are imposed by the rules only? What happens when there's also a statute speaking to the issue?
I have a copy of 6B. I would assume it applies to any deadline. I believe your question is more towards where can it override a deadline. The statute here is no more explicit than Rule 38E is. The statute says that if you fail to comply with the rules, it shall be waived. And that's exactly the same language that appears in 38E. I don't believe there's any reasonable way to read that statute as overriding or overruling the discretion in Rule 6B.
Let me ask my question in a little different fashion. It appears to me that 6B says when by these rules a deadline is imposed. And it also, in reading the answer brief, it looks like there is a statute under Title 13 that also applies to the issue of waiving a jury trial. And so I would like you to address the impact of that statute, and does 6B still apply?
Yes, I can give you the statutory language. Failure to pay the jury fee at the time of the demand or no later than 10 days after the service of the last pleading shall constitute a waiver of the jury trial by the demanding non-paying party. That's the exact same language that appears almost verbatim, I believe, in Rule 38E. I don't believe it is reasonable to construe that language as holding that the legislature thought that this deadline was completely unenlargeable. Rule 6B is how we deal with unavoidable and unexpected events, ranging from natural disasters, tornadoes, wildfires, to car accidents, sudden illness, things of that nature. And to read this statute as strictly as that, as Premier has urged, is to rule not only that the computer glitches aren't enough to enlarge this deadline, but that nothing is, that there are no unavoidable acts of God or of any kind that would justify filing the jury fee, 11 days late or 11 days after the demand rather than 10. That's not a reasonable interpretation of the legislature's intent. It is far more reasonable to believe that when the legislature wrote this statute, it intended to effect a new policy change. That policy change was to collect the jury fee from all demanding parties as opposed to just the first demanding party, which was the rule prior to 1989. As an enforcement mechanism for that new policy, to remove the trial court's discretion to order a jury trial simply because it thought one would be helpful, which was what Rule 39B used to read prior to the 1990 changes to the rules. It is not reasonable to think that the legislature, to construe the statute as meaning that the legislature wanted to overrule the court's discretion to manage its own litigation deadlines or to manage the process in the courtroom, especially in light of excusable neglect and circumstances that would warrant enlargement under the circumstances. Standard of excusable neglect, moreover, is an equitable standard. And it should be noted here that Mr. Einspar thought he had paid the fee. He was not attempting to game the system. He was not attempting to ride on somebody else's coattails, somebody who had paid the jury fee. He believed the fee to have been paid, and he found out otherwise only at the 11th hour. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal unless you have any further questions at the moment.
Thank you.
Bruce Rohde of Easton Rohde for the Appalese Premier and Quality. May it please the court. The 6B issue was not raised in the trial court. The closest that I can see that the arguments that are being presented today were presented to the trial court is in the supplement to the motion to reconsider the motion to permit the untimely payment of the jury fee. And it is there and only there that one finds the argument today characterized as a computer glitch lodged. And it is said to be the failure of the clerk to have collected the jury fee. In the supplement to the motion to reconsider the court's ruling on the motion. And with all due latitude to pro se litigants, I submit that that's simply insufficient. And what we truly see here today is an appellate invention, an effort to invoke 6B after the trial court itself had no opportunity to really consider the interrelationship of rules 6B, 38, 39, 121, and CRS 1371-144. Instead, only this court is asked to visit that argument and basically decide that Rule 6B can vanquish a statutorily required waiver, a waiver of one's rights, not simply an enlargement of time, but a waiver that has taken place by no less than three separate rules and a statute. Ironically, the last of which adopted rules 121 was, according to its notes and comments, adopted to eliminate any final administrative confusion regarding that waiver. So what the court is asked to do is basically stand a long-standing rule of statutory construction that the specific governs the general. And here we have 38, 39, 121 in the statute governing jury requests and the payment of jury fees. And instead the general, 6B, which generally applies to extension of time of rules, is supposed to govern instead. And that, of course, has not been the law in Colorado for well over 50 years. James v. Merrill, McConnell v. District Court, Unigard Security, Crawford v. Melby. I dare say we could ask any active practitioner in this state, what happens if you don't pay your client's jury fee on time and they tell you without hesitation, you waive your right to a jury? So if this court, and I say this respectfully and seriously, is truly going to rule that 6B trumps 38, 39, 121 and the statute, and attorneys can rely on court clerks and computers, and under an excusable neglect standard, I submit this would be a profound decision that should be published. And look at the facts here. the jury demand made first in an amended answer lodged with the clerk, not as an answer in jury demand, but as an amended answer, and not with the jury demand at the end, and with no even argument, not even today, that counsel did anything to check up on the clerk and make sure that the fee had been paid. So whose job is it? Is it the litigant? Is it counsel? Or is it the court clerk?
Well, counsel, in this case, wasn't Mr. Einsbauer essentially arguing to the court that counsel also had dropped the ball by not paying the jury fee?
Well, he at first he argued not only that it did his counsel drop the ball, but he specifically called his counsel negligent and invoked, implored the trial court, if it could, to reprimand his former attorney. Now, that's not excusable neglect. That's negligence. Then the argument changed to, well, my attorney tells me that LexisNexis or the court clerk automatically pays the fee, and that he is sure that that happened here. That was what was argued in the motion to reconsider. Then he changes his argument to, in the supplement to the motion to reconsider, to the clerk blew it. And I submit that, first of all, the argument wasn't properly raised, the rule doesn't apply, but even under the rule, this does not amount to excusable neglect as a matter of law. The court has any further questions regarding the jury issue, I'd like to address the indemnity issue. What's troubling about this part of the appeal is that it sets up a false premise, a straw man, if you will, and then knocks that straw man down. In the opening brief, the second issue is framed as the trial court erred in concluding that Colorado law never imposes on employers a duty to indemnify an employee on a tort-based damages claim. And that argument is repeated throughout the brief. And I hope as we've been able to point out in our answer brief, that's simply not what the trial court held. The trial court held that an employer has no right of indemnification from the innocent employee. Here, the trial court, in several places, all enumerated in our answer brief, made it, I think, abundantly clear that it was not finding that Quality, the employer, knew about the power booking, although it knew that such practices took place in the industry in general, and notwithstanding the fact that, frankly, it took place under its own nose. But it didn't know about it. Certainly didn't direct Mr. Einsbauer or co-defendant Nelson to do what they did, defraud one of my clients, Premier, out of tens of thousands of dollars by power booking. And yet we invoke equity here. The court found the opposite. The court found that Mr. Block did not instruct Mr. Einsbauer or Mr. Nelson to power book. The court found that Quality called Mr. Einsbauer and Mr. Nelson in on the carpet, so to speak, and extracted their agreement that it garnished their paychecks to help repay Premier some of its losses, eventually accepting $25,000 from Mr. Nelson in settlement of Quality's potential claims against him when he left Quality's employment. These are not the acts of folks who are in it together, so to speak. I suppose one could imagine facts, you know, those facts as being consistent with that kind of behavior, but I respectfully submit that those facts are much more clearly consistent with the employer and the employee not being in it together.
Oh, let me ask you this question. So as, let's address this first. So is it your position that if, say, an employee is negligent, but an employer authorizes that behavior, then it would be sufficient under vicarious liability to seek indemnification?
I wouldn't say it would always be, but it certainly could be. I think that's what the Cerna case stands for, perhaps in dicta, but stands for, and that's what the restatement stands for. So sure, if you direct your employee to perform a tortious act, and that employee is found responsible to the victim in damages, sure, you know, under the restatement law, and I think consistent with Colorado law, the employee under those circumstances could seek indemnification. This is not a contribution case, importantly. It's an indemnification case, and I think clearly there's no right of contribution from a non-innocent wrongdoer, tortfeasor employee, against an employer who's left holding the bag for that wrongful conduct. That's just not the law of indemnification in Colorado. So I respectfully request that the court consider awarding fees on this appeal. I think one other time in my career I've asked for that. But there's got to be a point, you know, where the resources and authority of the court is guarded against appellate, with all respect to zealous, creative appellate advocacy, arguments like this, you know, from people found to have adjudicated to have been guilty of behavior like this.
Thank you.
Just a few quick points, Your Honors, in rebuttal. On this question of the statute for the jury fees, the legislative history of the 1989 statutory change is devoid of any mention of any intent to make this the one rule in the entire procedural code that is as strict as Premier urges it to be. That legislative history shows an intent to collect the jury fee from both parties or from all demanding parties, and that's the only thing the legislative history shows. The legislative history of the Supreme Court for the 1990 rule change is identical. It shows an intent to collect the jury fee from both parties. It does not show that this is going to be a uniquely unenlargeable deadline. Notably, Rule 6B lists those that are uniquely unenlargeable, and they all deal with the finality of judgments. As to excusable neglect, Mr. Einspar made a motion on the spur of the moment in which he typed up in anger at his former attorney when he found out that the jury fee had not actually been paid. That was 7 months later from when the amended answer was actually filed. And his characterization in anger at his former attorney does not control the question of what actually happened. The facts are not really in dispute here. The court, apologize. The facts are that the amended answer was filed, a jury demand was made, LexisNexis did not cause, and the court clerk did not cause the statutory fee to be assessed to Jake Epler's account. In fact, it couldn't. When you file an amended answer through LexisNexis, there is no option for an amended answer and jury demand.
I have a question. When Quality had requested a jury, was there any payment made at that? I don't believe in the record show there was a payment made by Mr. Einspar at that time.
No, he did not demand a jury in his original answer. It was in his, Mr. Einspar demanded a jury in his amended answer, which included cross claims that created the right to a jury trial independent of the complaint itself, the original complaint by Premier and Quality and Block.
All right, I guess I was asking whether Mr. Einspar was also required to pay a jury fee when Quality had asked for a jury before it had settled, I believe.
If he had demanded a jury in his original answer, he would have been required to also pay the fee at that point to protect his right for a jury trial on those questions. However, the right to a jury trial is triggered anew with each pleading that creates a new legal claim to be tried. And so when he filed his amended answer with cross claims against Quality and Block, he was allowed to make a new jury demand at that point, even though he had not in his original answer. And that triggered his new 10-day clock to pay the jury fee. And he thought that it was paid at that point. Moving on to the indemnity question, the trial court held that, quote, under Colorado law, however, a negligent employee has no right of indemnification from the innocent, albeit vicariously liable, employer. Premier has just argued that because the word innocent is in that sentence, this sentence includes all of the requisite factual findings that are necessary, and the court did not apparently hold that this indemnity is never available under any circumstances. I would submit that a fair reading of that paragraph would not support that reading. A fair reading of this paragraph, the court looks at law, well-settled law, that indemnity is available in the other direction, and then holds that it's never available in the direction that Einspar seeks. And then the court went on to the next legal question. It never did make the requisite factual findings. And to read all of the requisite factual findings into that one word, innocent, is a stretch. Moreover, there are a lot of factual findings in here that would support the opposite inference. The court found that Einspar was directed explicitly to engage in other illegal conduct, and for that reason, these factual findings need to be found, and a new trial would be necessary on this error as well.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.